Hello, MonsterVine.com readers and Indie Complete listeners. This is Kyle Haste, host of MonsterVine's Indie Complete podcast, and I'm joined by Ian Dallas, creative director at developer Giant Sparrow, here to talk about their upcoming game titled What Remains of Edith Finch, which happens to release on Tuesday, April 25th on PlayStation 4 and Steam. Giant Sparrow is also the studio behind the award-winning 2012 title, The Unfinished Swan. Thanks so much for joining us, Ian.
Oh, my pleasure.
And for listeners, you can actually hear music from the game playing throughout this interview. In What Remains of Edith Finch, players find their way through a series of short stories with Edith Finch, a woman who has returned to the abandoned Finch family estate that she has inherited, a huge seaside home packed with the remnants and memories of the past. All the Finch family has died over the years except for Edith, and the bedrooms of the deceased have been sealed off. And so, with each generation, more rooms have been built onto the estate, resulting in an increasingly surreal structure that is explored throughout the game. With that in mind, Ian, for listeners, can you take us through a bit more of the experience this game presents and how it works?
So, you play as Edith, and you know, you're exploring the Finch house, but in each of these bedrooms, you'll find a story about how that family member died, which then becomes its own kind of playable game. So each of the stories is a very different game mechanic and different art style and time period and point of view. So you're kind of learning about your family history by exploring both the house and the stories.
Mm-hmm. And it's a very story-centric game, so it's a little tricky to delve too much into the experience since it's so story-centric. So I'll try to not spoil anything from what I've played so far too much, but with that in mind, I've played the stories of Molly Finch and Calvin Finch, mm-hmm. and from what I've played, I've noticed that every moment I have a strong feeling of wonder, and you don't necessarily build anticipation for events, but rather have like unique and surreal events happen very regularly. Mm-hmm. And with that said, how do you capture somebody's wonder, and what are the pitfalls to watch for when doing so? I imagine there's like infinite ways to convey a story poorly and lose people's interest. However, when I'm playing, you definitely had me hooked with my interest.
Oh, good.
And on top of that, as a developer, the wonder must be gone for you after knowing every nook and cranny of the story from pretty early in development. So how is it that you captivate a sense of wonder and not mess it up?
It is an unending challenge. And I don't think that there's, you know, much that, you know, is prescriptive about what it is that evokes a sense of wonder. Although there are a few guiding principles or things that work fairly regularly. I mean, I think in terms of wonder, like the equivalent, you know, like jump scares, for example, right? Like if someone turns around and like, you know, a monster jumps out at you, it's a fairly basic thing. In wonder, I think the equivalent of that would be going from like a big change in context. So something that, you know, like if you're very, very like a small enclosed space, and then suddenly, you know, going to a very large open space has a tendency to evoke, you know, an appreciation for the scale of things. Mm-hmm. Wonder is something that also, you know, correlates to the natural world often. Like people experience wonder more often in natural settings. I'm not sure why. I mean, all these things are just like guesses, you know, on my part. But, you know, for our last game and for this game as well, they're really explorations of the unknown.
Right.
And, you know, trying to put players into spaces that they've never been before, you know, and seeing the world through new eyes, which, you know, kind of inherently has, you know, the potential to create moments of wonder and awe and just the experience of something shockingly new. Mm. But, you know, one of the things I've noticed in watching a lot of people play through these games, you know, over the years, is that a lot of it also comes from the player. Like, it's quite possible for two people to play through the exact same, you know, piece of the game and have radically different experiences.
Right, yeah.
So, you know, the people that come away, I mean, there are people that, you know, come away speechless. Like, they actually, like, they don't have words to describe what just happened, and it takes them, you know, a few seconds to collect themselves. But then at the same time, there are people that play the exact same thing, and they enjoy it, but it, you know, just kind of rolls off of them and they're like ready to do whatever's next. So, you know, I think some of it is us, you know, trying to cultivate that moment, you know, and design for it. But a lot of it is also, you know, goodwill on the part of the player and, you know, player being open to experiencing something like that. And of course, you know, I mean, we try as much as we can to create a space where players are encouraged to invest themselves and, you know, making something that feels, you know, like they're stepping off into a really new space. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of a little bit confusing, but, you know, at the same time, not frustrating. That's something that as game developers, we focus on a lot when we're developing these experiences, trying to make sure that, you know, players feel like it's always something new, but that they're never confused about it, you know, is kind of a paradox.
Right.
But is the result of just a lot of playtesting and then, you know, getting feedback from people and trying to kind of hone in on, you know, what we can do to balance those things.
Do you still feel a sense of wonder running around the game yourself as well? Like if I, I've made things in the past, like video comics, for example, and if I'm still in editing for, you know, months and still laughing at my own jokes for the 400th time, I'm pretty confident that somebody will laugh at least one time. Do you still get that sense of wonder and feel like, you know, I'm pretty sure somebody else will kind of get this flicker too? I imagine you mentioned you do a lot of playtesting, but does that still factor into your feeling as you're playing?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very different experience that I have now. You know, because when I look at the game, I'm not seeing the same thing that a player sees.
It's like when a cameraman watches a movie, or you know, somebody knows how the sausage is made, sort of thing.
Yeah, and with the game, I mean, it's almost like a parent, you know, looking at a child. Mm. Like it's not just the thing in front of you; you're also seeing like the past and the future as well.
Yeah.
You know, like when I look at a room, I think about, you know, the three or four different versions of that room that we had to go through, you know, to get there. And the decisions that were made. But, you know, I think when I look at someone else who is playing it, you know, I actually do still get that sense of wonder, you know, particularly when it's someone who's kind of vocal. Like people will just say like, wow, 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 you know, these parts. You know, it's very nice to see like, okay, that part is working. But I no longer am able to play it and trust my own judgment. Mm. I have to kind of watch other people play it and intuit, you know, based on, you know, what they say and their body language and, you know, particularly in a first person game, what they're looking at, you know, like how long they spent on interviewing place.
That makes sense.
Is really suggestive of kind of where their head is at.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's also, you know, something, a game like this, you know, that is, you know, kind of an indie game, but also a game with a development team, you know, that like got up to about 16 people its height. There's a lot in the game that I didn't put there and I don't even really know about. So it's impressive that I'm always stumbling across things that just like, you know, little touches here and there that is really, I mean, it's not the way that a player would see it, but, you know, I'm continually amazed at how much we were able to put into this game and how many different currents from the different people involved, you know, found their way in.
For the gameplay and the interactivity, it varies from short story to short story throughout the game, keeping things fresh and kind of unpredictable. Kind of reminds me a bit of the overall approach of games like Night in the Woods that did that well as well. Can you tell me a bit about the outlook on the gameplay elements?
Sure. So, you know, each of these stories ends with a death. So they have this kind of natural shape to them. Mm. And we wanted each story to feel like they were giving you a different perspective on the world. So we wanted them to kind of evoke who the, you know, family member of the story is about, but also kind of what their world is like. So like in one of the stories, you know, you play as a young girl having a dream. So it's like, well, what does a young girl's dream, you know, feel like?
Mm-hmm.
Or in a story, you know, you're kind of like a angry teenage boy flying a kite, you know, and obviously there's, you know, a bit of, you know, kind of music and aesthetics that would suggest, you know, this boy getting angrier and angrier. But, you know, we tried as much as we could to embed that in what the player is actually doing in terms of, you know, when you press the buttons or, you know, the joysticks, like how does the world respond to you? You know, and luckily, you know, because these stories are relatively short, you know, we could make them very particular. Like each one of them is, you know, almost like their own game.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we just tried to make what you were doing and the, you know, the mechanics of the world, you know, expressive of, mm-hmm. of that character's, you know, world.
That makes sense. Like I'm thinking of, I think it was regarding the dream you mentioned, it was Molly Finch, I think.
Yeah.
And like from one moment, she's like a cat in a dream. It is like my dreams are pretty delusional at times. This one is really awesome in that regard. And so you're at one moment you're a cat leaping from branch to branch, chasing I'm guessing maybe is it a sparrow?
It's a finch, maybe? small bird. Yes.
Okay. Got a couple to work with there.
Yeah.
But you know, you finally get to the branch to jump and get the bird, and suddenly. Well, I won't spoil too much, but you're tumbling through the air, and suddenly you're is this an owl?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then soaring through the air. And it's just that motion, it just feels like how transitions in dreams happen, which are, you know, it's hard to think of how a transition in a dream works in general since they're hard to remember.
Right.
But, and then it, you go through that experience, then it tumbles kind of into like a shark's experience, and then it goes from there and whatnot. And my worry coming into a game like this is there's so many different types of gameplay elements you're making and trying to perfect. And whereas a game, you know, a first-person shooter can work on their, you know, their act, their motion for the same thing that's going to be used throughout most of the game constantly, whereas yours is so unique from one-to-one. Is that a challenge, I imagine?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly a challenge in terms of, you know, figuring out a schedule and deciding, you know, how much time do you spend on this story versus that story? Mm-hmm. You know, and there's a trade-off of making something that's really, really different from the other stories. You know, it feels, you know, more exciting, but then also, you know, just is that much harder to polish and also just to explain to players as you're, you know, moving right. your way through. So, you know, kind of like what I was talking about earlier, like we're trying to balance, you know, these shockingly new moments with something that doesn't feel frustrating. Mm-hmm. And you know, luckily we were able to, you know, spend because of the long development time, you know, to go through and do these large play tests and just see how a bunch of different people respond to that and then, you know, keep adjusting it. But, mm-hmm. You know, I think we've ended up at a place where hopefully for most players, the game is going to feel like falling down a rabbit hole
yeah.
where they're aware that like lots of things are, you know, streaming past them. But there's nothing that, you know, you get hung up on too long, you know, and you just sort of remember this blur that has happened to you. Mm-hmm. And that actually ended up being one of the harder things about developing this game is that because we're throwing so many different things at players, you know, there's a tendency for it to feel a little bit, you know, either jumbled or, you know, to kind of forget or repress things that happened half an hour ago because you've moved on to like three different stories in that time.
Right.
So, you know, after we got a couple of these stories working and, you know, feeling like, okay, this is what it feels like to play through several of the stories in order, you know, we started to try to figure out how do we connect these things and make it feel like, you know, they're not entirely separate, which grounding them in a family is a big help.
Right.
That even if the stories are, you know, very different mechanically and, you know, separated by a long distance in time, there's always, you know, an inherent connection between the characters in the stories. So, you know, it's like, well, the story is about this person's uncle and, you know, like this is the sister in that story becomes the mom in that story. And there's this kind of level that unites everything, you know, makes it feel like it's a cohesive family history at some level.
Yeah.
And not just a series of random tales.
Mm-hmm. And can you tell us a bit more about the Finch estate as well? It's extremely detailed, like obsessively detailed. I could just walk around it looking at the walls like for a long time. Like, what's the history there? What's building that sort of house digitally like? And do you miss working on it now that you're done?
Well, I'm happy that we're done.
Yeah.
And since I think we got to a good place with it. You know, I think just starting from the, you know, the ground up, the overall concept of the house is that in this family, whenever anyone dies, they close the bedroom door for that person and then leave their bedroom as, you know, kind of a monument or tomb to that person. Mm. So after a couple, you know, people have been born and died in the house, they start to run out of space. And then each generation basically has to build on to the house. So as you're playing, you know, as Edith, you begin on the ground floor, which is kind of the original part of the house. And then as you move your way through the game, you're also moving your way through like the history of the family, going from, you know, the original family members, you know, to like second, third, fourth generation, as you're getting higher and higher in the house. And it gets a little bit more bizarre as, you know, these people are building on top of kind of less stable structures.
Yeah.
So, you know, end up with something that's, you know, almost by the end, you know, kind of like Swiss Family Robinson. Looking. But, you know, I think the process of building the house for the Finches was remarkably similar to our own process in the sense that, you know, we're building something with a whole bunch of different people over a very long period of time with a lot of different ideas, you know, going into that. Mm-hmm. So the house ended up being super detailed in part just because we spent so much time on it.
Right.
Which is kind of the way that real houses work.
Yeah.
You know, like move into a house, like if you're like a new couple, you know, having a baby, whatever, you don't have that much stuff on the walls and, you know, mm-hmm. piling up in the basement or whatever. But after you raise a couple generations, you know, in a house, you just have more junk everywhere.
Yeah.
So, you know, we kind of naturally arrived at this thing that felt, you know, really appropriate to our world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it really tells a lot of story itself. And I love stories myself, but very rarely give myself any time to actually read like novels. Instead, I like games that have a well-developed story, be it an RPG or not. What's your outlook on like the market for story-centric games that aren't in the RPG genre like yours?
In some ways, I'm a little bit hesitant to describe it as a story-centric game, which I mean, I think you could make that claim.
Lack of a better word, I guess.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think it's accurate, depending on, you know, who you are and what your perspective is. Like, I feel like every game, you know, or most games, you know, should have some sort of story that's interesting.
Yeah.
And that it's not like this, like, rarity that there would be, you know, believable, interesting characters, you know, like with movies. Because they're, you know, because there's a human being that's there and, you know, like people interacting, you sort of naturally get much more of an emphasis on story. And with games, because, you know, you don't have to have humans involved, I think there's a tendency to, you know, kind of forget about, you know, the humanity in these events. But there's a lot of power in that, in like having things that tie into our real lives. So, you know, I think this game isn't really as much about story as it is about experience and what it feels like to be in these different moments and, you know, to see the world from different perspectives. So, I mean, there definitely is an overarching story that, you know, Edith is experiencing going through this, but, you know, the hope is more that, you know, we've created like a lot of unique moments that you're kind of working your way through and that, I mean, there's no ending also. I mean, there is an ending, you know, you get to the end and
right.
you feel like, you know, things have wrapped up, but it's not really about like a mystery to solve per se. You know, it's more about, you know, just kind of giving you an opportunity to think about some interesting people and why they made the choices they did and, you know, what the repercussions of that were. So it's kind of an invitation to consider some interesting ideas and people more than it is, you know, like a story with a discrete beginning, middle, and end. That being said, one of the nice things about, you know, telling a series of short stories is that, you know, we can have an overall goal that is somewhat amorphous, but at the same time have very clear beginning, middle, and ends for the stories themselves.
Right. Yeah.
It's a nice kind of happy accident that we found that we could, you know, mix those things together. So I think as a player, it really feels like there's a very, you know, linear, familiar story element to the game, but it's kind of sandwiched between you know, like a more kind of open and, you know, contemplative setting.
Mm-hmm. And something I was thinking about when I was playing is like, I could imagine if I tried to play this super slow, I might notice its linearity. But as I played, I wanted to move as fast as the story or kind of the pace of the story was being told. So I just kind of went naturally where I thought I would go and ended up being correct, basically. And so it didn't have that linear feeling, which was nice, too, considering all the surrealness that's going on constantly.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that also was something that we struggled with a lot. We got to a point where we had done a pretty good job of making the, you know, kind of first half hour to an hour of the game feel like what you're describing, where players weren't conscious that they were being led anywhere, but just felt like, oh yeah, I did this and then that thing happened. And they never felt like they were lost in a bad way, but they always felt like they were a little bit lost in a good way, where they didn't know quite where they were and what was going on. And all that helps a lot. I mean, we're trying to make a game about the experience of being overwhelmed. And so having players, you know, not quite know where they are in the house or what's coming up next is good. But we got to a point in development where, you know, we'd done a pretty good job for the first half of the game, but then after that, you know, got a bit rougher. And what we found is that players got incredibly lost after that because they had, you know, kind of unconsciously gotten themselves into a state where they felt like this was not a game that asked them to care much about, you know, finding things,
right.
that they would just sort of like wander through and sort of, you know, gape at this room or that room and they would magically discover these things. So when that stopped working, we ran into a lot of trouble. So we had to spend a bit of time, you know, kind of polishing the last half of the game to match the first half, which was challenging because we had a lot more time for the first half.
Right.
But yeah, we ended up with something where, you know, I think players feel like it just magically works. Not that, you know, again, like not that people feel like they're being led, because the game is really about exploration and that sense of like, I'm in an unfamiliar place trying to find my way, but that, you know, you don't do a lot of backtracking, for example, or, you know, hit moments where you're just very frustrated, and that it's, again, more like you're falling down a rabbit hole, which was just the magic of playtesting that we failed over and over and over again, you know, and had a lot of really unhappy playtesters that got lost so that we could figure out, you know, how to subtly make things better. And a lot of times it's something, you know, very, very subtle about, you know, teaching where a light is coming from, or, you know, the angle that a chair is turned. And then it's like, oh, well, now, you know, 9 out of 10 people have no problems with this room because of these, you know, tiny things that they got adjusted.
And actually, on that vein, kind of works into this a statement I more had written down, that not so much as a question, but I'm curious your thoughts on it. But in a lot of games, players' concentration is mostly focused on their inputs and their calculations that are going on during gameplay and divided away from any story that's going on. In What Remains of Edith Finch, input is very subtle, doesn't divide your attention, and instead your mind is working away a lot more at absorbing what's going on and the wonder in the story there. Kind of like a book brought to life that players control and navigate. As a result, my feelings moment to moment are very different than in a traditional game. Do you get that?
No, and I think what it sounds like it echoes is something we haven't really talked about, which is in video games, the tendency for players to drop into familiar modes. And I think for me, like, the dominant experience that I have with most games is, you know, a call to challenge, you know, where, like, I'm given the tools and then I am asked to perform, you know, and to find like an optimal strategy or to confront and overcome. And so, you know, you kind of stop focusing on the context or even the kind of moment to moment joy of the movement or, you know, whatever the mechanic is. And instead you focus on this kind of middle ground, I think, for most games, that is about, you know, trying to do this thing so that you can unlock this other thing, you know, and it's mostly, you know, I think, related to challenging the player. So we try to avoid those kind of situations, you know, by keeping players in, you know, a state of constant discovery, so that it felt like, you know, you were just getting comfortable and exploring, you know, like what this new movement, you know, what it made possible. So, for example, in Molly's story, you know, you become a cat and you're jumping around these trees and chasing a bird, you know, but it's more about like feeling that out. And it's less about like, okay, now, you know, you've got to, you know, get 3 birds before, you know, this, you know, clock reaches, you know, a certain time, and focusing on that kind of,
and you fell out the tree,
deep exploration. So we kind of kept things mechanically superficial, partly just to keep players more in that feeling of discovery, and then also to keep them thinking about the kind of broader context of who am I and what do I want, and what are the kind of narrative elements here, but try to avoid slipping into, you know, the more familiar, like, okay, I'm playing a game, let me play this game well.
Yeah, I'm definitely enjoying it myself. I try not to lather up my praise at the beginning of the interview, but I'm definitely gonna pick it up myself. I'm very curious about what happens next. Like, I think you've perfected the sense of wonder and whatnot that we've talked about, like, exceptionally well.
Well, it sounds like you're also in a good place, you know, per the earlier comments. You know, a lot of it is, like, it's a very two-way street, so you have to be, you know, willing to put a bit of yourself out there
for sure
to get that back.
And this is not so story related or really gameplay related, but kind of more development related for my final question here. But I've heard developers talking about the challenge of making their second game as a studio. What sort of new things kind of happened or did you run into making your second game as a studio?
Well, I think there's a tendency to want to do more, where, especially when the first game, when you're pretty happy with it, you feel like, oh, you know, I kind of understand how this works. Let me try to do a bit more of that, you know, go a little bit deeper. And, you know, I think on this game for us, I mean, the most obvious challenge was just that we were doing, you know, a much more detailed world, you know, and much more mechanically dense. So, right. I mean, it's a lot of similar kinds of concerns about, you know, how do you evoke a sense of wonder and, you know, how do you make something that doesn't have a lot of like HUD elements and traditional, you know, kind of game elements that are there for very good reasons, you know. I understand why most games have mini maps and objective markers and all the other things, but like, how do you find, you know, alternate routes that serve that? But yeah, I would say, you know, it's a, in my experience, you know, there were a lot of similar problems, but just at a higher volume, you know, dealing with a larger team and a more ambitious project.
So were your like solutions to those problems kind of scalable from last time around?
To some extent, you know, I think just, in terms of the process, understanding that you're not going to get it right the first time, and you're also not going to get it right the second time. It's going to be at least the third time. By that, I mean, you know, complete redesigns, which is painful when you feel like, you know, and this happens to us a lot, you know, where you're designing, for example, a bedroom, and you feel like, yeah, like this is, you know, it does most of what I want. I'm like 80% of the way there. And then you spend another week and you're like 82% of the way there. And another week and you're 83%. And it's just like smaller and smaller improvements. Mm-hmm. And you realize like, oh, crap, I need to completely scrap this.
Oh, no.
You know, in order to do something that's going to be a lot better, you just need to start over and take what you've learned, but, you know, do it better. And, you know, you just, you can't invent something as easily when you're tied to what's already there. It's just too tempting to try to keep improving it. So, you know, and that was something that we learned very painfully on the first game, you know, where just, you know, we kept trying to make things better and failing. And then just in disgust, we were like, all right, fine, we'll just start over. And this time it was a little bit more like, okay, well, we've reached that phase again where, you know, we're not making much progress and, you know, everyone feel like we should start over. All right, we'll start over. So, you know, it's the same things happening, but there's less hand-wringing about it when it happens to you.
Gotcha. So, you know already that these things can be overcome one way or another.
Yeah, and that, you know, this is, you know, a pretty good process for taking something where you have, you know, this kind of a very clear goal, but not a clear implementation, where you're like, okay, we want it to feel like, you know, this reference photo, for example, like this is what it, this emotion is what it should feel like this, or this song or whatever, but you don't really know how you're going to get there. So doing these failed experiments is, you know, I think a relatively efficient way to go from, you know, this kind of unknown space into something where you can kind of talk about it, and it just, you know, gives you a more concrete path of attack, you know, and something that you can discuss with people, and you can throw ideas back and forth. When you have something that's tangible, people can make their own adjustments to it. But when it's just an idea, you know, on a whiteboard or something, you know, those conversations can go on for hours and lead nowhere.
Right.
So these failed prototypes, you know, and these failed design blockouts and stuff, you know, end up being at least an effective way. Maybe not the most efficient, but it does get you there eventually.
Right. And a little anecdote that kind of pops to mind as you're talking about the rooms there. And I think the end result of what I've played so far, at least for Molly's story and then also for Calvin, was I guess it was you start in like a pink washroom and then you crawl through a crawl space. Is that, that's part of Calvin's story, I believe? Yeah, because then you go into the spaceship thing. So I was walking through Calvin's side of that room you find yourself in, and I was looking to the right as you're walking towards the door, and I see his bed, and he's got this little drawbridge over his bed going into like a little kind of almost like a tree fort-esque little structure. And as I was walking past, I was like, man, if I was a kid, I would love that. And also, it'd be so great if I could just walk up there. But of course, I'm probably too tall, not going to happen. Then sure enough, the game takes me through there. I was like, oh, yes, this is satisfying just for the inner child in me. So the rooms are well done is basically what I'm getting at from my experience.
That room was one of the harder ones. You know, it's a bedroom with twins.
Yeah.
And it took us so long to figure out, you know, how to show that there were two people in that room, because people just kept thinking, two beds. The way we solved a lot of these problems actually was just duplicating information. So, you know, there are rooms where, like, one of the problems we had, for example, was that people didn't remember the names of who was in the bedroom. Because if you look around your own bedroom, you probably don't have your name written more than once, you know, maybe on a piece of mail or something.
Yeah.
So, you know, we, and everybody, you know, explores these bedrooms a bit differently as well. So, you can't guarantee that someone is going to necessarily, you know, take in the place where you've written the name. So we just put the names in a lot of different places in every bedroom, like everywhere we could think of. And then, you know, an average player will see like one or two of those and, you know, hopefully it'll stick in their head. But
a good teacher once told me that repetition is remembering. Mr. Christofferson.
I think that works spatially as well as verbally, that, you know, seeing something, you know, a couple of times just, you know, makes it more likely, which is especially helpful in a game with so many things going on. It's always felt like a kindness to players to, you know, try to put it in front of them as often as we can, because, you know, they're not always thinking about what we want them to be thinking about. But if it's nearby, you know, it's just, there's a greater chance that our interests will align, and then, you know, suddenly things will become clear for them.
Exactly. And that pretty much wraps up my questions. I was just curious if you had any kind of final things you want to mention to listeners or readers about the game and where they can follow it or where they can find it.
No, I mean, I think beyond the obvious that, you know, it's available on Steam for PC and on the PlayStation Store for PS4. And it'll be out on Tuesday this week, April 25th. And for more information, you can check out our website at giantsparrow.com or follow us on Twitter at giantsparrow.
So that pretty much wraps up the interview there. I really appreciate your time, Ian. I think everybody should check out the game if you are piqued your interest throughout this conversation. And thanks again for your time.
Thank you.
This has been a MonsterVine.com Indie Complete interview. Don't forget to check out the site for more gaming coverage. And like Ian mentioned, you can find out more about what remains of Edith Finch at the development studio website, giantsparrow.com, or on their Twitter at giantsparrow. Back at MonsterVine, you can also find and subscribe via iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud to the podcast I host called Indie Complete, where we feature indie developer interviews like this, as well as each month we tackle one indie game that epitomizes the best of indie games. We just released an episode about Night in the Woods, and our next episode will be on May 15th, covering Hyper Light Drifter and more. You can also find us on Twitter at MonsterVine and at Indie Complete.